This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.
The people from below will push for real change.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
Welcome to the Indie Media Show on RTR FM 92.1. Huge thanks to Jeff for another excellent edition. You're welcome to dribble over anytime, mate. It's always a great start to the week here with On The Record on a Monday. But of course, you can catch On The Record every weekday on RTR FM from 9 in the a.m., as I said. And as you should hopefully know, this is the Indie Media Show. That's the news and interviews from the open publishing wires of the interwebs. My name is Raymond Grenfell. Brahma's in the studio as well, keeping up the positive vibes. On this week's program, we're going to be, taking a bit of a look at some of the climate in action at the recent COP summit. We covered already on the show, the COP27 summit that was taking place in Egypt. But we're going to be hearing from Dr. Simon Bradshaw, who is a research director and author with the Climate Council. He specifically looks at a lot of stuff to do with extreme weather, bushfires, health security, and many other areas of climate science and impacts. He was at the summit, the COP27 summit, and our good friend Andy Payne caught up with him to hear about that and just the reality that we've had 27 of these summits and still very little action. Really, if you look at, the sorts of action that climate scientists are saying that we need, that our governments need to take in terms of reducing greenhouse gases and emissions, we're really not doing our bit. So we're going to be hearing from Simon a little later in the show. We're also going to be talking about a project that's been going on for a while, but you might not know about it. It's called the Commons Social Change Library. It's a pretty incredible library. It's got thousands of educational resources set up by a bunch of folk over east in Naarm or Melbourne. We're going to be catching up with researcher and academic Dr. Ian McIntyre to talk a little bit about the Commons Social Change Library. They've got a bit of a push for donations at the moment because they need some help. But it's an incredible resource and definitely worth hearing all about. So we'll be catching up with Ian a little later in the show to chat about that as well.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
Now, as we head into summer, I'm sure many of us are already starting to worry about the potential effects of, extreme weather events and fire, as we've witnessed over the last few years. And unfortunately, these sorts of events seem to be only increasing as we experience the effects of catastrophic climate change. One person who is very much aware of that and has spent much of his life researching it is Dr. Simon Bradshaw. He is a researcher on climate science and the impacts at the Climate Council. He's been a writer and campaigner for climate action for over a decade and was formerly the climate change advocacy lead at Oxfam Australia. His research with the Climate Council covers extreme weather, bushfires, health security, and many other areas of climate science and impacts. He was recently at the COP27 summit in Egypt, another one of these summits that, of course, many of us saw, watched, and really it passed without a lot of action being taken. But our good friend Andy Payne from 4ZZZ over east, and a former Indie Media presenter, had the opportunity to speak to Dr. Bradshaw while he was in Cairo attending the summit.
Dr. Simon Bradshaw, I'm the research director at the Climate Council, and I'm in Egypt for COP27.
So before we go any further, I suppose there's been a lot of COPs now, as the number indicates, but some people probably still don't know what it means and what it's all about. So could you start by telling us what COP27 is?
Of course. So every year we have a big round of climate negotiations. Comes in November or December. This is where all the world's countries get together to negotiate how they're going to step up cooperation in responding to the climate crisis. It has been a near three-decade process. It's painfully slow, especially given the extreme urgency of the climate crisis and the impacts that we're seeing play out around the world in Australia. But it is a critically important part of the world's response to climate change, and Australia's back in the game this time, but with a lot of catching up to do, a lot of damage to undo, and so we're here to really try and push things as hard and fast as we can.
So there's a lot of governments from around the world and things like that, but you're there, I assume, as part of the Climate Council. Is there a lot of other NGO and civil society groups?
There are about 35,000 delegates altogether. It's an enormous conference. Now, that includes government delegates, it includes media, but it includes a very large civil society contingent as well. I think there's about 40 or 50 Australians on the ground. That includes a much larger representation from First Nations voices than we've seen previously, which is a hugely important step. And many of our friends from Pacific civil society as well have really shown up with a very powerful message.
Yeah, well, that's been one of the big topics talked about at the COP, has been about developed nations who made a lot of wealth off fossil fuel use paying compensation to developing countries. Can you tell us a bit about how that conversation has gone?
Well, look, there's really three elements of climate change. There's what's called mitigation, that's driving down our emissions, tackling the problem at its source. There's adaptation, that's ways to kind of cope with and adapt to the impacts that, owing to past inaction, we are now facing. And then increasingly, there's had to be a focus on loss and damage from climate change. These are the impacts to which it's impossible to adapt. The land being lost to rising seas, or entire harvest being wiped out in a stroke by extreme weather events. And going into this COP, we have seen over the preceding months a run of truly terrifying extreme weather disasters around the world. The floods in Pakistan, the prolonged droughts and extreme heat in Eastern Africa, pushing many people to the brink of starvation. So it's really brought this issue of loss and damage to the fore at this COP. And there's been some very fierce and effective advocacy from a number of regions, no more so the Pacific, to get this higher up on the agenda and to really force a reckoning on the need for additional funding to address loss and damage.
The developed nations have traditionally been quite resistant to this idea. Is that starting a change this week?
Look, I'd say they're still mostly dragging their heels, giving fairly mixed messages. Encouragingly, funding to address loss and damage is on the formal agenda of this COP for the first time. Also, Australia is aspiring to co-host a future COP with the Pacific, COP31 in 2026. Now, that's an exciting prospect, but it obviously does bring a lot of additional scrutiny and expectation onto Australia, in particular, the need for us to support Pacific priorities, which includes, obviously, accelerating the world's exit from coal and gas into clean energy and to be driving down emissions this decade. But also this issue of loss and damage. So if we're to be a worthy partner of the Pacific and hosting a future COP, then we absolutely need to be stepping up on this issue and supporting that priority, putting in funds ourselves to address loss and damage.
We'll come back to Australia's bid to host COP in a second, but what other topics have been on the table at COP, and what's been discussed? Has there been any developments, exciting developments or bad developments or anything?
Look, there's so much goes on at COP, it can be hard to keep track, but just to talk about some of the key trends, the key issues. Look, we're on the African continent, you know, part of the world where the costs and impact of climate change really is being measured in rising hunger, in communities being forced from their land and homes, in entrenched poverty. And there is a big focus, among other things, on raising more finance to support communities coping with the impacts of climate change. This is finance for adaptation is another thing, as well as what we've talked about with loss and damage. And more generally, ensuring a real step up in support for climate action from the wealthy developed countries like Australia to parts of the world that have done very little to cause the climate crisis, and yet are being hit first and hardest by its impact. So that's a theme running throughout. We're also seeing a lot of talk about the importance of centering climate justice and human rights in climate action, and that there really can be no climate justice without First Nations justice. We need to recognize that self-determination is fundamental to tackling the climate crisis. Certainly hanging around the Australian Pavilion, a lot of talk about that. In terms of key developments, a very interesting new tool launched yesterday called Climate Trace, launched at a big event with Al Gore, which brings a lot more transparency to emissions from not only countries, but individual industrial facilities around the world. We've been looking at that, pouring through the data, realizing yet again just what a giant of the fossil fuel industry Australia is and how much work we have to do to drive down our emissions and support those on the front line. But it's really finance, addressing loss and damage, and just stepping up action in line with the extreme urgency of what we're seeing and the real things that are dominating here.
And Australia is keen, as you mentioned, to co-host the COP summit in 4 years' time. Is it likely to happen, and what will it mean?
Well, Australia is very serious about this bid, and it's giving itself a four-year run-up. That's a lot of time to prepare. It's not assured that we will get to host the COP, but I reckon it's a pretty good prospect at this point. It would be the largest diplomatic undertaking that Australia has ever done. It means really moving to a role of global climate leadership to be in that seat. And keep in mind, we've spent the last decade or last many decades dragging our heels, doing a lot to frustrate progress in these talks. I think for Australia to really step up and be a worthy recipient of that role, obviously we've got to get our own emissions plummeting. We need to be moving from being a fossil fuel giant to a real clean energy superpower that's helping accelerate the world's energy transition. And we really need to be supporting vulnerable communities around the world with adapting to the impacts of climate change and addressing loss and damage. We've got to be prepared to really set an example on those fronts. And we've got 4 years to get this right. Keep in mind, come 2026, we'll be more than halfway through what really is the make or break decade for climate action. If we don't have emissions plummeting by then, we're in very serious trouble. So, look, we see this as a great opportunity to really push and stretch and extend what Australia is willing to do. And because it's a big responsibility we're proposing to take on here, and we'd have to give it our very, very best.
All right. Thanks, Simon. Is there anything else that we should keep an eye on as the summit draws to a close?
Well, Ministers Bowen and McAllister will be arriving in a couple of days. They'll be here for the whole of the second week. Minister Bowen has already said he expects the negotiation on loss and damage to dominate. So we'll have to see what Australia is willing to put on the table. We do really have to show meaningful solidarity with the Pacific if we want to host a future COP together. One thing we always have to remember is that Australia has been a big part of the problem historically, but is poised to be a very big part of the solution if we really want to. I mean, we're sitting on some of the world's best renewable energy potential. We've got everything we need to not only transform our energy system, but to be building new clean industries, playing an outsized role in the world's energy transformation response to the climate crisis. So we have to come out of this COP having ticked the key boxes, supporting a loss and damage finance facility, helping enable a big step up in climate finance globally, showing that we're prepared to exceed our current target of 43% by 2030, which only doesn't really catch us up yet with the rest of the world, but that we are also really serious about playing our parts over the coming years. And as said, Australia's got a lot of catching up to do, a decade of damage that it's done, but we're here back in the game. But I think we've got a ways to go yet to show the world that we're really serious.
Okay. Thanks very much, Simon, for chatting with us.
Thank you very much, Andy.
That was Dr. Simon Bradshaw from the Climate Council speaking to Andy Payne a little bit over a week and a half ago. But the COP27 has now wound up, and perhaps inevitably the latest global climate policy summit in Egypt failed to create any binding agreements on emissions reduction. Though, as Dr. Bradshaw was talking about, there was some moves towards compensating countries that are bearing the brunt of climate change. But, you know, we will see as the COPs continue to roll out whether anything is ever actually done.
You're listening to the Indie Media Podcast, first broadcast on RTRFM 92.1.
This is the Indie Media Show on RTRFM 92.1. Myself, Raymond Grenfell, and Brahma in the studio as well. And now we're going to chat about what I think is an incredibly exciting project that's been going on for some time and very useful and vital, and that is the Commons Social Change Library. Before we really explain what that is, I think it's probably better to get someone who's been heavily involved in the project to explain it. We're joined now by Dr. Ian McIntyre, who's involved with the Commons Social Change Library. Thanks very much for joining us, Ian.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Now, I guess for a lot of folks, they might not be familiar with the concept of a social change library. In fact, they might not, sadly, be familiar with the commons as a concept at all, given the state of the world at the moment. But I guess maybe perhaps a good place to start is, can you just, I guess, explain the project? What exactly is a social change library, and, you know, how does it work, and what sort of role does it play?
Yeah, so the Commons was set up about 3 years ago, and basically what it brings together is over 1,000 kind of resources in terms of kind of guides, podcasts, videos, articles, book reviews, all to do with campaigning and creating social change. So it's an online library, it's not a physical library. And it kind of, our focus is on making social movements stronger and smarter. And within that, I guess the focus is very much kind of practical how-tos and things to consider and challenges, how to, you know, different ways to overcome typical challenges and so forth in campaigning. And within that remit, we cover a very wide range of kind of viewpoints and methods. So, I mean, I guess in terms of content, you know, it's got everything from how to run and organise a blockade camp through to how to write a letter to a politician, you know, how to start a new collective through to organising models for, you know, large non-governmental organisations. There's stuff about sort of theories of change, organising, digital campaigning, taking care of yourself in terms of well-being. There's a whole bunch of First Nations resources, stuff about coalition building. So, yeah, it's a very kind of broad set of resources which, you know, are free for anybody to access via commonslibrary.org.
Yeah, awesome. It is something, I think, for anyone who's spent any time involved in social movements or in activism and within these communities. I think it's something that, unfortunately, you know, we don't always do well. And I mean, I guess, you know, speaking purely from an Australian context, I think elsewhere in the world, maybe there is, you know, perhaps more intergenerational knowledge. But I think it's something that, you know, maybe as activists, it tends to be this thing where people get involved in a campaign or in a movement for a decade or for a few years, and perhaps they get burnt out, and then another group of people come along, and, you know, because nothing's changed, they sort of attempt to reinvent the wheel. Is that really one of the main sort of motivations for yourself and others to really try and provide these resources so that people don't have to come into things totally new? And I think we can maybe look at some of the younger movements around at the moment as good examples of that, like the Student Strike for Climate and so forth. Is that really, you know, one of the main functions of it?
Yeah, look, I think we kind of aim at, again, you know, in the 3 years, we've built this pretty huge collection. So really there's stuff there for people who are complete novices, you know, and totally new and, yep, really important to sort of, you know, give them the tools, yeah, to avoid, I guess, making mistakes and to be more effective right through, you know, but we also have materials for people, you know, who've been active for a long time you know, perhaps want to think about how to do something differently or, you know, I mean, one of the common traps, I think, and, you know, this goes for myself, you know, in terms of sort of campaigning and stuff is often you kind of find a style or a set of tactics and strategies that you feel quite comfortable with and you kind of stick with them even though perhaps they're not as effective in a different context or whatever. So, you know, we're definitely got, you know, good materials, I think, for people who are new to stuff. You know, we've got a number of sort of topic guides and so forth and where to start in the collection kind of guides. So, you know, if you've never formed a group before and you want to think about what are the key questions and how can we do this, put it, you know, identify the problems, identify, you know, potential solutions and so forth for totally new activists, that's all there. But, I hope we also challenge longer-term activists to kind of think about their practice and how they might do things a bit differently.
We're speaking to Dr. Ian McIntyre from the Commons Social Change Library. Ian, you're also a researcher. You've recently published a book on the history of obstructive direct action and environmental blockades in Australia. And, you know, I guess, you know, reading that, there's a real, I guess one of the things that stands out is a lot of these blockades, whether it was Terania Creek or others, it wasn't just the campaign that was important. There was also the things that were created, the organisations that were created. For instance, you know, the Greens being perhaps one of the most notable ones. Out of these blockades. But do you view this library and the Commons Library as something that can sort of contribute to, I guess, creating alternative visions for the world, alternative forms of social organising? I mean, I imagine there's a bit of resources around consensus decision making and so forth. And do you think it has a role to play just in that regard, that, you know, people who are perhaps thinking about alternative forms of social organisation can, you know, can do some research and perhaps, you know, apply some of these practices to their real lives?
Oh, definitely. I mean, yeah, really. The library's all about, facilitating and encouraging social change. And, you know, so we've got a lot of materials that talk about doing that at a deeper level and really encourage people to think, I guess, about their kind of theory of change. And, so we do have, lots of articles about lots of different theories of change and about different means of achieving change. You know, you mentioned consensus decision making, and that's often, for the people who use it, it's seen, I guess, on a practical level as, you know, potentially a very, you know, democratic and inclusive, what if it's done properly, way of making decisions. But it also has, what people call a prefigurative kind of element in terms of kind of practicing the future that we want to see in the present. And, so we're always adding extra materials. We've got somebody writing an article at the moment about prefiguration, this idea of practicing, the future we want to create in the present, and looking at, you know, a whole bunch of different ways that activists do that, whether it's in the way that they run campaigns to specifically change things, or in kind of creating alternative institutions, you know, food cooperatives, and other housing cooperatives and other kinds of institutions. So yes, look, it's sort of sometimes I think one of the issues we've got is the collection has become so big, and that's where the kind of introductory articles. I mean, people can do searches if they know specifically what they want, but you know, often, you know, in a recent radio interview I did, you know, we had a caller sort of ring in and say, you know, what works sort of thing. that's a common question, but it's sort of like, well, that's going to be really hard to answer in a short interview. But, you know, if you have a look, they were specifically thinking about organisations. So it was like, well, look, you know, we've got a sort of introduction to organising part of the website. So maybe start there and, yeah,
and if it was that simple, perhaps we wouldn't all be living under this neoliberal bloody hellscape still.
Yes, and we certainly wouldn't need a library with a whole heap of resources. You just need one resource. But I guess that's one thing we certainly try to avoid is being too, you know, is being prescriptive.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of saying there's only one way to do things, and because obviously we wouldn't be in this situation we're in if there was a simple solution.
I just want to also ask, I mean, an aspect of this, and you talked a bit about prefiguration, I mean, the actual library itself is commons, as you know, is a Creative Commons project, I imagine. And it's unfortunately, you know, we said at the start of this interview, a lot of people perhaps don't have much of a concept of the commons, even though here in Australia, the commons was a very integral part of our culture. And early on, you know, going back to sort of squatters' rights, and it's, you know, very much surely ingrained in our history. You know, how integral is this concept of the commons to the library, and how does it sort of practically work in terms of, I imagine, you know, the resources are free to download and share and so forth?
Yeah, so I guess I'll try and briefly do the concept justice, but the idea of the commons are, I guess, the things that people do and should hold in common for free and have access to no matter what, and should be outside of private ownership. And the concept goes back to pre-industrial times, when even though people were under the thumb of feudal lords and so forth, there were areas of land which were just open to anybody to hunt on and to gather from and grow crops on, and you know, so it was like a shared space for the good of everybody. And of course, through the Industrial Revolution, those spaces got more and more chopped up into private ownership, and the sort of access to the commons was lost. I guess today, you know, if we think about the commons, then it could potentially be access again to common spaces, and we have some of those that, you know, anybody can use, but it's also water, air, and in the case of the Commons Library, knowledge. So we're sort of saying, I guess, with the materials we share, the idea is that, well, this is knowledge that is kind of, comes out of collective movements, comes out of, you know, movements of groups of people. And we're trying to sort of bring it together in a place where anybody can access it for free. That's how the sort of the, you know, it's our shared knowledge, and it's it's there for the common good of all.
Certainly a fantastic idea and project. So I guess if people are interested, what's the best thing they can do? How can they support the project or even participate in the project? What's the, you know, the best thing for our listeners to do?
Well, yeah, if you want to check out the materials, then the address is commonslibrary.org. So, you know, that's the first thing people can do, is just use our resources. if they were, you know, we're open for people volunteering. People can write articles. We've just recently run a series of workshops, online workshops about creating resources, which doesn't mean you have to create them for the commons, but how to create educational resources to do with, activism, trade unionism, social movements. And they're kind of available on our website, and that's sort of a guide to, you know, things like book review, how to write a book review or how to do an interview or and so forth. So yeah, if people want to kind of contribute content, if people have had, you know, we have lots of case studies on the website where people can kind of read about the history of different campaigns and kind of draw the lessons out from them. So, you know, always looking for people to share their, you know, either themselves or they can contact us and look at sharing, you know, their stories and experiences of activism. And people can also donate to the website. And currently we're kind of running a end of year crowdfunder, and if people donate a certain amount, then they get a Commons calendar, which has, sort of 12 beautiful images of different protests and actions and rallies and blockades and so forth, or they can become a regular donor. So yeah, lots of different ways to get involved.
We've been speaking to Dr. Ian McIntyre from the Commons Social Change Library. Thanks very much for speaking to us today, Ian.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
And you're on the Indie Media Show on RTR FM 92.1. It's now time for a bit of indie media news, starting in the United States. In Colorado, the gunman suspected of shooting and killing five people at Club Q, the LGBTQI plus nightclub in Colorado Springs, has been indicted for murder and hate crimes. Officials have identified the five victims as Daniel Davis Ashton, a 28-year-old trans man from Tulsa, Oklahoma, Kelly Loving, a 40-year-old trans woman who just recently moved to Colorado, and 38-year-old Derek Rump, a Club Q bartender, 35-year-old Ashley Paul, and also 22-year-old Raymond Green Vance. Richard Fierro, a retired military veteran, has been identified as the person who confronted and disarmed the shooter. Fierro was at Club Q to watch a drag show with his wife, his daughter, and Raymond Green Vance, one of the victims who was his daughter's boyfriend. Fierro was deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan four times and said in an interview with the New York Times the experience still haunts him. He left the army in 2013 due to the brutal psychological and physical toll of war and said he never thought he'd experience the same violence at home. Staying in the United States, members of a union representing U.S. freight rail conductors voted to reject a tentative labor contract. It's the fourth and largest of a dozen rail industry unions to reject the agreement brokered by the Biden administration last September. Many of those rejecting the deal said the tentative contract failed to address chronic staffing shortages, long hours, and unpredictable schedules. If any of the unions decides to strike, others will honour their picket lines, setting up a potential nationwide strike by more than 100,000 workers as soon as December 9. And in related labour news, in China, hundreds of workers at the world's largest iPhone factory have clashed with Chinese police after walking off the job. Tension has been rising at the Foxconn plant over strict COVID-19 lockdowns and unpaid wages. Videos posted on social media show workers being tear-gassed and beaten outside the plant. And a coalition of over 400 immigrant justice and human rights groups are urging the Biden administration to grant temporary protection status, or TPS, to more people from Haiti as the island nation faces a political and economic crisis with violence increasing in the streets. The efforts led by the Haitian Bridge Alliance are calling for current beneficiaries of TPS to be given more time in the program and for Biden officials to expand the relief to Haitians who fled the United States after July 2021. And as we reported in the show, in Sharm el-Sheikh, delegates at the UN Climate Summit agreed on Sunday to establish a landmark loss and damage fund to help the Global South deal with the worst effects of the climate catastrophe, largely caused by rich countries. The US, historically the world's worst polluter, was the last major holdout on the proposal before finally agreeing to fund to the fund on Saturday. But it's still unclear how these commitments will be enforced. In the US, such funds would need to be appropriated by a now split Congress. Meanwhile, activists, the UN and vulnerable nations have condemned the lack of action on lowering emissions in order to reach the goal of keeping global temperature increase to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. That's it for the Indie Media News. That's pretty much it for the show, in fact. We'll be back next week. You can always restream the program at rtrfm.com.au. It's also available as a podcast. You can listen to a lot of our interviews on our SoundCloud. And please do get in touch if you've got an idea for a story, if you've got something you want to talk about. We always love to hear from you. You can get in touch with us at studio.rtrfm.com.au, or you can always hit us up on the social media if that's your thing.
You're listening to the Indie Media Podcast, first broadcast on RTRFM 92.1.